reflections on the past and possibilities in the present. Join us for a concert July 7th featuring Egyptian Cotton Orchestra, Montreal Free Jazz, Kim Dong Wong, free improv based on Korean traditional music, Skunk Heaven, New York City Noise, on July 7th, 2022, at 9 p.m., La Sala Rosa, 4848 Saint Laurent. For more information on the concert and conference on protest music and anti-fascism, music and antifascism.wordpress.com. This concert, with generous support from Suoni per il Popolo and Popolo Press. This is a CKUT Radio co-presentation.
From Turtle Island to Palestine, occupation is a crime. Free, free Palestine! You're listening to Radio Free Palestine.
Welcome everyone, you are listening to Under the Olive Tree, the Palestine Solidarity Radio Show on CKUT 90.3 FM in Montreal and on CFRC 101.9 FM in Kingston, Ontario. Stay tuned.
Hello and welcome to the CJP Me Debrief Podcast, a project of Canadians for Justice and Peace in the Middle East, and a proud member of the Harbinger Media Network. Together, we discuss developments and issues in Canada's relationship with Palestine and the broader Middle East. Through our conversations, we make sense of events in the region and how people in Canada can respond. Since last year's escalation of Israeli violence in May 2021, many people have noticed that the media's portrayal of Israel and the Palestinians appears to be shifting. How is this change in the public discourse manifested? How substantive is it? And what is influencing it? Together, we talk about what has and hasn't changed and the forces of pushing it one way or another. Joining the conversation today is Professor William Laffey-Humans of George Washington University as we talk about the changing image of Israel and the Palestinians in media and public opinion. My name is Tom Woodley. I'm the president of CJPME and the podcast host for today. With me is Michael Buchert, CJPME's VP and our podcast co-host. Good morning, Michael.
Good morning, Tom.
So we have a very interesting guest joining us today. We have Professor William Humans. Professor Humans is an associate professor at the George Washington's School of Media and Public Affairs. His primary research interests include global news, law, and politics. His other areas of interest include researching terrorism, American international broadcasting, Middle East politics, and Arab American studies. He's the author of a book about Al Jazeera in the U.S. and is regularly quoted in the Washington Post, Newsweek, and the New York Times, in addition to appearing from time to time on CBC, NPR, and Al Jazeera English. Will, we are just so pleased to have you with us. Thanks so much for joining us.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Well, I gave the sort of official title, the official introduction of you and your role as a professor at School of Media and Public Affairs at George Washington University. But how would you describe the focus of your academic interest and research for our audience?
Thank you for asking. You know, an academic loves to talk about the research, even if the listeners aren't as interested. So right now I'm working on a project about Arab American media, not just media that's made by Arab Americans, but Arab American engagement with media. And of course, you know, the topic for today's discussion, Palestine, figures pretty centrally in that history. Yeah. It's a history that's only going back to about the 1980s. But because media advocacy is part of that, my story that I'm interested in telling, it positions me to have a sort of longer view of the history and the trajectory that I see today. I'm generally interested in U.S.-Arab relations as it sort of plays out through media and communication.
Yeah, and I guess in sort of looking into your background, you've been involved, you know, not only in sort of academic research, but you've also been involved in film documentaries and things like that as well. So, do you see that sort of as just all working together to sort of create a body of material out there that people can sort of plug into? Or
I think so. And, you know, there's a term out there that is me search, and sometimes it's used pejoratively. But the way I see it is sometimes you just do better by focusing on what you're intimately familiar with. And because I've been in media production and various capacities, I feel like that makes my voice sort of most valuable in talking about the things that I feel comfortable talking about and knowing about. But yes, I'm working on a documentary about the unsolved assassination of Alex Auda, who's a Palestinian-American activist and a media activist in Southern California. And that was in the year 1985. And so that documentary brings together sort of media, politics, criminal justice system, U.S. federal government, and international relations. So it's a kind of a culmination of all my different interests that come together. But I do believe that, yeah, my media practice work informs my sort of academic inquiry as well.
Yeah, no, I think it makes sense. And you bring so many rich experiences and Arab American yourself as a lawyer, as a professor and so on. So it's, and it brings also the insider perspective versus the out. You're doing this not as an outsider, but as someone who really knows the media landscape. So you mentioned to us in previous communications that one of your keen interests is the changing image of Israel and Palestinians in U.S. public opinion and consciousness. And as we said earlier, there's an awful lot to dig into there. How do you want to sort of talk about this? Should we separate the question of Israel and the Palestinians and look at each of them individually, or what's the best way to talk through this?
Well, it's very difficult to separate them when they are seen as being so intricately connected.
Yeah.
And sometimes in a zero-sum way, which I think is a bit unfortunate. So what I would feel most comfortable talking about is, you know, how do we actually analyze this? And what are sort of useful metrics and measures, and what are less useful metrics and measures? And so if I can proceed in that direction, I can start by telling you what are the prevailing ways to think about this and why they don't actually work very well.
Sounds good.
Thank you. You had to say yes, right? I think that there tends to be a focus in U.S. political discourse on public opinion, and it's this sort of, you know, changing barometer that's focused on numbers, and they call it, you know, favorability. Are you more favorable towards the Israelis or the Palestinians, or sometimes it's the Israel government versus the Palestinian Authority? But we can look at these numbers, and politicians look at these numbers, and there's many polling agencies that produce these numbers and newspapers that cover these sorts of findings, and there's a lot of symbolic value given to them. And generally, they actually tell a fairly consistent story over time, which is that public opinion in the U.S. largely favors Israel, with a minority sort of favoring Palestinians. And again, it's put as a sort of zero-sum calculus. the limitations of this are many. One of them that I'm interested in is that when you ask someone their opinion on something, it can range, that what that opinion is can range from sort of a faint impression to full-on devoted zealotry, yeah. And they get measured exactly the same.
Yeah.
There is such a huge gap between awareness, knowledge, and willingness to take action.
Yeah.
And so you could, and a lot of people who study these issues focus on sort of public opinion as the major measure. I don't think it's that interesting. I think you have to look at what people are actually doing on the ground, what's happening at the level of sort of political culture, what are the sort of prevailing discourses, or how are the messages being framed? And then looking also at how there's evolution in terms of representation, both who can speak for the populations and how are their narratives or their stories being told. And I would also position this conversation within, you know, larger discussions around transformation in the media technology landscape. And, you know, the big story there is that the old gatekeepers of traditional news media have lost a lot of power, and they're competing more and more with a fragmented media sphere where there's the rise of lots of new content producers, lots of new journalists who aren't traditional journalists or are activist journalists. And so I think that the other danger I would warn about is when we analyze this, that we are standing in these various bubbles, and that we can tend to overstate the importance of what we see happening in our bubbles.
Yes. So
it's very hard to actually get out and sort of take a bigger picture, because the scene is very chaotic from the outside. There's so many new voices, and there's so many new sources, and there's new political constellations that are very strange. So those are the things I would kind of focus on, are like, who, you know, those qualitative questions of who's speaking, what are the stories being told, and what are the new sort of politics that are coming up.
Yeah. You know, we've done a number of surveys over the years about Canadian perceptions on Israel-Palestine and public opinion surveys. To your point, if you're interested, we can send them to you later after the podcast. But in fact, I remember we were presenting the results to a politician, and of course the results sort of show that a lot of Canadians are sympathetic to the plight of the Palestinians. And the politician looked at it and he said, "Yeah, but like, how motivated are these respondents? So only if you only have 20 or 30% who are sort of favor Israel in some of these discussions, but they're much more motivated, then that's what he wanted to know." And so these really are, it goes beyond just, as you say, you know, grouping sort of everyone in these vague favoring this or favoring that category. So true.
Yeah, that's a great point. And that's the danger of overemphasizing, you know, discourse or kind of what is being said by whom or what information is circulating, when in many ways it still comes down to the nuts and bolts of, you know, who's willing to vote based on their beliefs, who's willing to take action, who's willing to make the phone calls, write the letters, do the hard work of pressuring politicians. So when it comes to, you know, measuring at the level of foreign policy and the machinations around policy making, it's still going to be that good old fashioned, you know, work that pressure takes. And so the politician's asking the right question. In the U.S., they'd be asked, well, who's giving me money? you know, who's voting? And that's kind of what they would base it on, more so than just levels of public opinion. But I agree that sometimes when you can show numbers, that becomes a communicative device in and of itself. So there's value there. But we can't say that the politics are completely changing based on the fluctuation of these numbers.
Right. So in terms of some of the changes, what are some of the changes that you're seeing? Are we looking back all the way to the 80s to today, or what are you seeing?
Yeah, I don't have to give a historical lesson based on my research as much as I would like that. Other than I would like to say that there's a couple of things that have been happening in the past, you know, two decades that I think are really important. One is, you know, the two-state solution has been declared dying so many times. I mean, it's pretty much an annual ritual in D.C. Yeah. for someone to say the death of the two-state solution. But I think we're really at a point now where the narrative the sort of range of voices that are that can enter the mainstream debate, the elevated debate, I think that it goes, it's going beyond the sort of two-state solution. So it's taken several decades to surmount that limitation to thinking about the conflict, because it was never that a Palestinian state was going to really resemble any kind of real justice for the Palestinian people, given the centrality of the Nakba in 1948 to the Palestinian experience and the Palestinian refugee issue. And so Washington had really played, I think, a disastrous role for Palestinian struggle and tying it down to this faulty paradigm that was that you know, visionaries like Edward Said said was doomed to fail in the 90s. Yeah. So I think that there's an opening in that regard politically, and I think it collides with, or I shouldn't say collides with, but is congruent with the elevation of new kinds of voices. There'd always been Palestinian spokespeople that sort of emerged, right, but a lot of them only emerged through sort of official channels, and because mm-hmm. they've been in a way blessed or sanctified by a certain political elite.
Right.
And so who was able to speak for the Palestinians was filtered by so many gatekeepers. But I think now you can see on social media, like the rise, for example, of Mohammed Al-Kurd and his sister Mona, sort of strong young Palestinians who embody a certain, you know, a certain spirit, are willing to speak frankly, directly, in an uncensored way about the things that they're experiencing, the ethnic cleansing that
absolutely
they're doing in Sheikh Jarrah. And they have platforms, they have audiences, they have people that are willing to listen to them and amplify them. And we had people who spoke like that in the 1990s, but they were cordoned off, and they were limited in who they were sort of able to reach and speak to. But, you know, that's an important thing because it all goes back to the question about the permission to narrate. And it seems like these social media technologies are enabling Palestinians to take that permission for themselves. Of course, there's a lot of problems that happen because social media platforms are trying to silence a lot of these individuals, and their social media policies also get exploited by the pro-Israel crowd to sort of, you know, exploit them. Like over-reporting as hate, certain kinds of messages, right, and things get taken down. So there is like another conflict around just the right to use the platform that's still happening. But I see more plurality in the voices. It's no longer that the PA spokesperson can really be the voice of the Palestinians on this issue. So I'm fairly optimistic by some of that, especially because when you look at younger generations, they seem much more familiar or much more informed than even my generation was when we were their age. So I see that in the students that I teach. It's just more sophistication.
Mm-hmm.
They feel a lot more they feel a lot more engaged with the things that are happening on the ground.
Yeah.
That said, you know, how do we get from all this to actually, you know, shifting sort of foreign policy or making, you know, Israel less attractive for politicians to support? And it may take some time there.
Yeah. No, you make such good points. And Mohammed Al-Kurd and Mona Al-Kurd are fantastic examples. And I sometimes feel sorry for them, that they're just so young and such a burden has been placed on their shoulders because they have a certain platform. And it's tough. And they speak with such sophistication. So hats off to them. Very impressive. And I agree with you that the plurality is certainly helpful. If you have effective spokespeople, I think Mohammed Al-Kurd and his sister Mona are fantastic. But you could feasibly have a situation where someone has a platform to speak for the Palestinians and they don't do a very good job. And that has happened in the past as well. But excellent points. In terms of I guess you've talked about the social media being a driver of change. For you as an academic, what are the sort of ways that you try to measure this? Or how do you try to, is there a way you can quantify this and sort of track it over time?
It's very difficult to track it over time because, you know, academically speaking, you'd want to have the same measures that you'd be deploying over a long span of time. But when new technologies emerge, you know, earlier studies just couldn't really take them into account.
Yeah.
That's why I keep going back to the public opinion question. And when I looked at some of the stuff like the Gallup polls that happened over time, they don't show any kind of sea change that's happening.
Mm.
But of course, a lot of the figures I looked at are sort of just sheer numbers, top line.
Right.
But you don't. There could be segments of, or segments of the population, or groups within a population, where there's change. Like the young might be becoming more pro-Palestinian, and some of the data that I was looking at just didn't sort of get there.
Mm-hmm.
But I would look at, for example, how activists. I would be more interested in sort of qualitative analysis of how activists' demands change over time. And so you could look at sort of BDS movement. And right. In many ways, I mean, the efforts of legislators and the lobby to sort of squash that show its sort of potency.
Yeah.
When in the past have state legislatures been sort of conscripted to fight Palestinian activists, you know? So as great as all the activism was happening in this, you know, late 60s, 70s, 80s, never before did the Texas state legislature have to come down on them.
Right.
And so you can kind of look, I kind of like to look at qualitative events more so than looking at just numbers. And, you know, the growth of student organizations and student activists is important. But at the same time, we do have to face the question of the decline of like traditional advocacy organizations in the U.S., at least the large sort of membership-based ones. A lot of them were Arab American organizations. So that has been a little difficult to witness, but at the same
time... Sorry to interrupt, just as examples, are you talking like about the Arab American Institute and groups like that, or what are some of the groups that you have in mind when you talk about the decline of the traditional...
Sure. So in the 70s, AAUG, which was an organization for university graduates, was one of the predominant voices. The National Association of Arab Americans, which merged with ADC, American Arab Anti-Discrimination, and which is not the size that it used to be and the potency that it used to have. The General Union of Palestinian Students was a very active student organization of Arab students. But in a way, you could say, well, Students for Justice in Palestine rose up, and they're actually multi-ethnic, multicultural, and that gives them some power.
Yeah.
But there's something nice about having Palestinian organizations and Palestinian activists sort of speaking for themselves. But there are still pockets, but at that large national level, those big organizations don't exist as much. But you do have a lot of savvy organizations like IMBU, for example, does this great, tremendously valuable old school relationship building, pitching stories. There's so much work behind the scenes that they actually don't get a lot of credit for. And that kind of model is a valuable model. Working behind the scenes is important. I'm not even privy to the kind of work they do, but I feel like I see the results. Like even with the New York Times, I feel like it's improved dramatically in the past decade. Yeah, I mean, not that it's excellent. it's generally a higher level of journalism than most American newspapers. And this issue, they've been subject to so much public criticism from the Palestinian perspective. Like there was a time when op-eds were just not...
Not possible.
And then in the past several years, we saw a lot more Palestinian American columns sort of getting in or as op-eds. And then it seems like even with the reporting this past weekend, I read some of the stories, and I thought they were much more rich and nuanced.
Yeah.
And sort of critical of Israeli actions. That said, there were a lot of missing things from the story, sort of the overt sort of clashes frame.
Right.
There's no sort of colonialism and occupation and no sort of larger sort of politics to this that really could inform what's going on. Instead, it's kind of put down to, you know, contestation over a religious site.
Right. Well, and, you know, we have to, of course, talk about last May. And, of course, lots of people said, we're talking last May about how sort of the mainstream media, the tone of the mainstream media towards the
Israel and the Palestinians had changed. And would you agree with that? And how would you describe that change?
Yeah, I think there were a couple interesting things that happened that, you know, over the many assaults on Gaza since 2008, 2009, there's been a sort of, I think, sea change. I mean, maybe sea change is a little dramatic, but there's this almost like, okay, you know, it's the same story that's unfolding. There's a little bit more cynicism, I think, towards the Israeli line, which is really a self-defense line. For one thing, like, it's always an overwrought response, you know? So they might say there's some missiles fired from Gaza, so we're acting defensively to root out Hamas. Well, how many times are you going to act defensively to root out Hamas and kill, like, hundreds of Palestinians? Yeah. You know, it's just, there's no proportionality there.
Yeah.
And, you know, at the same time, there's these inconsistencies like, look how great Iron Dome is. You know, it's this technological supremacy of the Israelis. We're going to protect ourselves. So if you've created this virtual sort of wall, then why do you have to massacre so many hundreds of Palestinians?
Right.
And you see this coming out in certain key pieces. Like if you go back to last May and you watch John Oliver, on his program, which was a very influential program in certain other policy areas, like the net neutrality debate. John Oliver basically had the FCC reverse itself at some point. So this is an informative program, and he's going and saying this is Israel committing war crimes.
Yeah.
To hear that on a mainstream news program was just sort of mind blowing. And then even with MSNBC and some of its staffing, like hiring Ayman Mohyeddin,
right,
in his own program, and he had covered Gaza from the ground for Al Jazeera English. He was someone who's intimately aware with Gaza. Yeah. And I think back in 2014 it might have been, I can't remember which one it was, they tried to muzzle him at some point. And this was exposed, and there was a huge backlash against it, and they had to let him talk about Gaza again. I don't remember exactly all the details, but there was this ability to sort of call out bias has, I think, improved the flack. Because you, as a social media critic, can go viral by showing some sort of discrepancy in coverage, discrepancy between the images and the video coming from the grounds. For example, in last May, when Israel demolished that 13-story apartment building.
Right, you know, with the media and stuff.
Yeah, pure act of collective punishment, an attack on media. You know, as much as Israel tries to explain it, there's all these people on the ground who can give counter testimony now.
Right.
That tension becomes more visible to journalists who are very online, very on Twitter, and receptive to that. Are forced to sort of confront that criticism in ways that they didn't really have to publicly before.
So at some level, the change has been sort of forced upon the media, that it's been less a voluntary thing and something that the media is sort of, they can't control it quite as well. There's more people publishing, there's more people providing insight, videos, testimonies about what's actually going on, and that's getting more air.
Yeah, but as you pointed out, for good and for bad, you know,
right.
At the same time, we have misinformation. I mean, even Ukraine, you can see some images from Palestine circulating as proof of Russian
aggression
and Ukraine. And then, you know, hateful rhetoric or cyberbullying or trolling, all this is also happening at the same time. But I also actually want to ask or want to talk about a little bit Russia and Ukraine. Because the outpouring of solidarity with Ukraine was kind of surprising in a way for me to see, because I forgot that Americans are capable of being so anti-war and anti-occupation.
Right.
And I'm not a big proponent of whataboutism, and I support the self-determination of people. So I want to see Ukrainians determining the Ukrainian future. That's my political view on that. But, you know, to sort of think that violent self-resistance is something that Americans can sort
get
of
behind.
Yeah, has been so mind-blowing for me, and I think a lot of Palestinians are sort of pointing out that this juncture, and that's not going to change everybody's mind, but I would like to think that some people would be forced to have to confront that cognitive dissonance especially if in the near future Israel becomes more confrontational and turns up the heat more, as we saw starting the past weekend.
Which it likely will. Yeah, we actually did a position paper where we compared the Canadian response to Russia-Ukraine to its typical response in Israel-Palestine. And we came out with 8 or 9 sort of really key areas in terms of, you know, attitude towards the ICC, attitude towards General Assembly resolutions, attitude towards providing aid, attitudes, so on and so forth. And it's just mind-blowing. You just can't.
And go ahead. On the media side, too, just to jump in, and we talked about this on a different podcast episode, but there are a number of things we've seen in the media coverage of Ukraine that are really interesting, like language policy rules that, well, they're going to say Kyiv now instead of Kiev, recognizing the political significance of the people's, the indigenous sort of perspective of how to name this place, while at the same time, that was the CBC article, they have a policy not to allow journalists to say the word Palestine, because it's not recognized as an independent state by the Canadian government. So, there are a whole bunch of things. You can see it. It's just so clear. The sort of the refusal, or this, they're so quick, the media is so quick to dismiss any Russian claims if they report on them at all, while anything that Palestinians say usually is overshadowed by Israel. Even just like this past week with the raids on Al-Aqsa, some of the reporting has been okay, but the stuff I've seen on TV, on the CBC or on CTV, all the footage they use is from the Israeli government or pro-Israel sources. There's image from inside the mosque. They choose not to use it. There's images of people being beaten. They use, you know, almost none of that. And so there's definitely, there are so many lessons from how you could responsibly, and in many ways, the Canadian media does responsibly report on what's happening in a situation of military aggression and occupation. And they just choose not to use those same standards.
Absolutely. And the reporting from social media sources is now extremely well developed and extremely well accepted practice. You know, if there's a natural disaster, they're culling video from every social media platform, and they're giving credit, and then all of a sudden on this, there's a huge discrepancy between what you're watching on television and what you can see on social media. You know, these sort of soldiers going by and beating people with batons who are just standing there, and the very sort of crude repressive violence that for Americans will remind them of the civil rights movement or many other sort of historical analogies that don't play in Israel's favor. Yeah, I mean, one of my constraints as a media scholar, to be honest, is that I just can't watch too much network television in the U.S. Television news is so disappointing and so much filled with so much conjecture and commentary. There's really very little that I can tolerate watching for too long. And so when I have to study it academically, I usually will use transcripts so I can get through it much faster. And I haven't looked at transcripts on this yet because I don't have my hope up though. Yeah, there is talk about Discovery Channel trying to return CNN back to reporting though. So I was very cautiously optimistic about that, because the state of TV in this country, at least, is just abysmal when it comes to news.
Yeah. Well, we have a few other things that we wanted to explore here together with you today. We've talked about sort of in general the media landscape and the potential for changing approaches. But in your opinion, what's the best way for grassroots groups or advocacy organizations to try to positively influence media coverage? And have they changed much, or are they changing much?
Well, you could probably, you know, speak to this question better than I could. But I tend to believe that the old school ways are still really important. And so that's really about relationship building. About generating both flack and sort of positive reinforcement for when things are done right. And that takes active media monitoring. Having lists of volunteers who are willing to watch and report on media. Of course, a lot of this can be done more fluidly with using technology, searches and that kind of thing. But you need people to make the calls, to make the send the emails, to post on social media. And I think it takes a level of organization, even though a lot of things happen organically on social media online. You know, a lot of people complain about a really biased headline and they'll pass it on and pass it on. And then that generates some sort of fire. But we really need people working behind the scenes, doing it the old fashioned way. In many ways, those human relationships are still instrumental to, I think changing practices and policies. And of course, one thing that I'm happy to see is that a lot of Arab Americans, especially, have gone into journalism, and we're seeing a little more diversity and representation in newsrooms. But it's still a huge struggle, and the communities of people who are pro-Palestinian, they need to be devoting themselves to careers in this field. But we see that it still can have a great amount of backlash. There was that young journalist at the Associated Press who had been a student activist at Stanford, and I think College Republicans or some conservative activists went after her, and they, I believe it was the AP later off.
Yeah.
And so there can still be, there's still this like effort to intimidate and prevent, in part because it's known that having that representation in the actual workplaces can affect the coverage.
Yeah. No, you're absolutely right, and that is happening. I think here in Canada, there's a little bit much more diversity is tolerated in media outlets. I think more so than America. And I don't have any sort of empirical basis to say that, but just my impression is that you see a lot of people of color on news channels and things like that, and a lot of racialized names as news hosts and things like that. I did want to ask,
I just wanted to cut in there that it's not necessarily the faces and the hosts, although we tend to think that they're so important. It's really the producers, the writers, the people who are working sort of in the newsrooms that can do the most to actually shape the story. And so we don't have to think about developing the on-camera talent or the people who are getting the main sorts of bylines. It's every aspect of the news business. We need to have people there who kind of get it. And that means families encouraging their kids not to, we don't need another dentist who's Arab American or Arab Canadian. We need to have people who are working in these fields, these intellectual fields that can have influence over society.
Absolutely. Absolutely. So true. You had mentioned in an email exchange about the problem of how social media platforms sometimes censor Palestinian solidarity activism. Is there anything that we can do to, I think, counter that type of thing?
It's very important that we put pressure on the media platform, social media platforms, just the same ways that we would monitor the news organizations. And I think that there's such a great network of organizations that monitor and publish cases like when they do happen. For example, I remember Zoom canceled a pro-Palestinian event that was being organized at San Francisco State University.
Right.
And so the backlash to Zoom has to be organized and deliberate and clear. And a lot of times there's just a lot of outrage, and then people pledge that they'll never use something again. And the moments pass, there's no policy change, there's no accountability, and people go back to sort of using it. Facebook is a frequent violator.
Mm-hmm.
And not just Facebook, but Facebook properties like Instagram. I mean, even, supermodel Bella Hadid, who's an important cultural figure, especially for younger generations, was just censored. I think one of her stories, it's called, or perhaps a post that was related to Al-Aqsa, was censored. And she's bringing publicity to that act. And so we have many different opportunities to do something like a campaign around this. Because really it is about censorship, even though the social media companies usually come up with some excuse like, oh, there was an error or there's an algorithmic, you know, bug that caused this to happen. I think that we need to be focused on social media policies and practices as organizations, as institutions that need to be held accountable.
Yeah. Well, and what I'm hearing from you again and again is that it's if we can be more structured and organized in the way that we do it, that it tends to be sort of incident driven versus sort of having a structure in place where we respond systematically and regularly. And as you said earlier, building relationships and not only criticizing media when they do a bad job, but also thanking them when they do a good job, you know, when they take the time to find someone who can adequately represent a Palestinian viewpoint or adequately talk about, you know, what's happening from a Palestinian perspective. So that's what we've all got to work on.
One other thing I would ask people is that journalists get emails and they get tons of social media messages, but what would happen if you actually sent them a letter in the mail? Mm. Old school style that they would read, that would be like unlike anything else. Sometimes I hear from journalists that when they actually get like a letter, it just stands out, you know.
Yeah,
or phone call even is so rare these days. But it takes resources and it takes organization. I know those things don't come easily.
Yeah, absolutely. Let's turn to a book that you wrote that you published in 2017. I'm sure you were working on it for many years before that. But you wrote a book called An Unlikely Audience, Al Jazeera's Struggle in America, where you talk about Al Jazeera's attempt to penetrate the United States media world. So they've had some successes and obviously some big failures. What does their story sort of tell us about American media and maybe North American media more generally?
I remember when I presented on my work in 2012 to an audience, there was so it was 5 years before the book published.
Right.
So I've been working on it for a long time. But there was a seasoned international correspondent who'd worked overseas for 3 decades. He rose his hand after my academic presentation. He's like, Americans just don't care for international news. That's the problem.
Mm.
I was like, oh, I forgot to take that into consideration. So I spent actually a little more in the book addressing that because of that one, you know, comment that I got. And I've never given him credit for it because, you know, he doesn't need credit. But that is a major, major problem. And in most of the conventional wisdom in U.S. reporting is that international news just doesn't get the same amount of attention. So you can compare like Time magazine's foreign magazine covers to the domestic, and like the Asia edition, the Europe edition, all of them will have the international news story will lead on the cover, even if it's about a different region or a different issue or something like that. And then the U.S., it's something very parochial, something more about lifestyle or culture and entertainment. Yeah. And so there is a sort of established condescension towards the American for just like for learning about the world. And there might be some reason why they think that. I mean, it might be well-grounded. It might be empirically supported. Certainly American knowledge of the rest of the world is famously lacking.
Yeah.
They issue kinds of knowledge quizzes to people right. in the world, and it's kind of embarrassing how poorly we do. It's also totally de-emphasized in our K-12 education. Our curriculum does not reflect international understanding. So there is something to that, and that's a huge obstacle for a foreign news company that is, you know, that watching it kind of requires some background in the world, you know, just to comprehend what's going on. And, you know, their model is to speak to audiences all around the world. So there is some presumption of familiarity there that I think
right.
makes it hard for them. And then, of course, Al Jazeera was just vilified as a brand during the Bush administration, considered an enemy. And so that's a huge report as well. But, you know, you don't have to please everybody to be successful with a media organization. In some ways, AJ Plus, its online brand, its digital sort of platform, it has been relatively successful, more so than Al Jazeera America, which closed its doors, obviously.
Right.
So there's a story there about the possibilities of of America connecting itself more to the world. And I think that maybe one of the positives out of the Trump administration, if I could say there's a positive, is that Americans can no longer deny that we're part of the world and we're subject to the same problems of the rest of the world, including the potential for demagoguery and hatred to dominate so viscerally in our politics. Yeah. And then, of course, COVID forces us to recognize that these borders are in many ways artifices. They're things that we've imagined as being so important, and we have to recognize that the lack of knowledge about the rest of the world is quite dangerous, actually. A matter of life and death in the age of a pandemic, and climate change will force that same sort of reckoning as well. And I think that Israel has gained so much from American exceptionalism. It could only thrive because of American exceptionalism.
That's true.
So I hope that with future generations we'll let go of these myths of the past and become much more worldly, although that's, you know, it's as much optimism as I'd allow myself.
It takes, and these things take time. That's you wish they could happen overnight, but they take generations. Yeah. Excellent point about the American exceptionalism sort of enabling the support and Israel sort of the way they were established and the way they continue to function. Let's close with a final question for you. You've also gotten quite a bit of visibility for an article that you wrote documenting how America's Central Intelligence Agency recruited Arab Americans from Detroit. And of course, here in Canada, we have the CSIS, the Canadian Security Intelligence Service, which I know is also, you know, recruits from among Arab Canadians. What might be your advice to the Arab Canadian community in terms of when they're approached by a security intelligence agency?
Well, what the advertising campaign for the Arab American community in Detroit was basically about, you know, here's the benefits to you, and you can serve sort of your country. And it was this sort of my warning to the recipients of that message would be, you know, you are the tool. You know, they're not the tool to you, to your success. And it's vital that you feel that you're being hailed as a citizen, as someone who has rights, and someone who should actually be informing the larger conversation about foreign policy. Because if you're not, you're really just being instrumentalized, which means you're being put to use, and you don't want to work for an employer that's going to put yourself to use. And so when I was writing about that paper, I was writing about, you know, how does this sort of governmental agency talk to this subset of the population? Do they talk to them as citizens, or are they talking to them as in some other capacity? And I found that they were being hailed as these sort of like foreigners that were in the U.S. who had citizenship by defending the nation, but that it would also benefit them in their careers, you know? Okay. And that's not really to me what this should all be about. This should be about inclusive foreign policy that brings our voices to the table as people who come region, we actually have a lot more knowledge and familiarity with the region and the so-called experts who are forming the policy. And so it needs to be that kind of involvement in the security agencies, to me, needs to be part of a larger conversation about how foreign policy is brought into formation.
Well, Will, it's really been a great pleasure here talking to you and sort of getting a sense of getting your perspective on these various questions of media and bias and opportunities in terms of shifting the narrative. So thank you very much.
Thank you.
If you're a listener and you've enjoyed our podcast today, please subscribe to our channel. We're on all the major audio podcast platforms. If you can, please leave a positive review wherever you get your podcasts. It helps other people to find our program and learn about the issues. This podcast is a project of Canadians for Justice and Peace in the Middle East, CJPME, and seeks to advance its mission to empower Canadians of all backgrounds to promote justice, development, and peace in the Middle East. If you have any comments, questions, or suggestions about our podcast or our topics, please feel free to email us at info@cjpme.org. Thanks to all our supporters who helped to make this podcast and all of CJPME's other activities possible.
Thanks also to Madeline Moffitt, our podcast engineer and consultant. So that's it for now. We'll look forward to having all of you with us for next podcast. Take care and have a great day.
وأهواك أشرب برد السجود لأنساك
So that's it for us for today. You're listening to Under the Olive Tree, the Palestine Solidarity Radio Show on CQUT 90.3 FM in Montreal and on CFRC 101.9 FM in Kingston, Ontario. Until next time, I wish you a free, free Palestine.
Political is thrilled to announce the theatrical release of...